you all for coming out on this sunny day. We worked really hard to get the sun shining for you. And we're pleased to have you here for the start of our 16th season at Castle Barton. So thank you for coming. And we're really, really pleased to have Gary Fabian Miller here with us and with his photographs and ribbon of story about his garden. So he will be talking about that along with Richard Ovenden, who is the Bodleian librarian for the Bodleian Libraries in Oxford and has other roles there as well. So I'm going to leave it to the two of them to talk about each other and what their capacity of knowing each other and also Castle Barton. But I just wanted to say it's a very nice synchronistic coming together of different parts of Castle Barton, because of course we have the holiday lets that operate all year round, and often the visitors that come are very, very engaged with the gallery and the events that we have here, and it's always nice when that happens. And in this case, Richard has been coming for several years and staying here, and it's just a wonderful sort of merging of the different parts of the Castle Barton venue to have that all come together today in the gallery and in our gardens, reflecting on Gary and Naomi's garden in their home. So I will turn it over to you to talk, and thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you very much indeed, Rhea. Thank you all very much indeed for coming and joining us this afternoon. And as Rhea said, it's a huge pleasure for me to be back here in Castle Barton. We've been coming for a number of years, but actually my own family has very deep roots back to the Lizard. My mum was evacuated here during the war to stay with her Uncle Reg and Auntie May in Garris. And I spent all my childhood holidays coming to stay with Uncle Reg and Auntie May, and so having any excuse to come back to this part of the world, we seize it. And today we're here in the art space here in Castle Barton. We can see the garden outside just about both of these doorways, and we're here to talk about another garden. The garden of Gary and Naomi Fabian Miller. And that's the inspiration for this exhibition that's in, hanging on the walls and on the plinth in front of us today. And that garden is 1,000 feet up on Dartmoor. And in a very different kind of space, a very different kind of context to the garden here at Castle Barton, but one in which art and nature have come together in extraordinary ways. And that's really going to be what we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so, without hesitation, deviation or repetition, to discuss this afternoon. And Gary and Naomi moved to Dartmoor in 1989 and to a house. And the house had land around it, which became a garden. And that garden has interacted with Gary's own artistic practice in a number of ways. And I think one of the things that I hope we'll try to explore this afternoon is where the art stops and the garden begins, and where the garden stops and the art begins. That sort of interplay is, I think, at the heart of Gary's practice and that exhibition. But the garden itself has grown and evolved over the time that they've been on Dartmoor, and now encompasses, I think, 13 acres of land. So it's more than just a garden. It's a place where there are ancient trees, there are different kinds of spaces for cultivation, different kinds of gardens. It sustained them both physically in the form of produce that they have cultivated and consumed, but also in other ways. So Gary, when you and Naomi moved there, did you have a kind of vision for what the garden would become, or how it would play a part in your lives?
So, let's see. So, we knew we wanted to make a garden. We knew we wanted to make a home. and we knew we wanted to make a meaningful life. I had made gardens before, and I was living in Lincolnshire. I'd gone to Lincolnshire from living near Bristol when I was 21, because I wanted to go somewhere where I could buy a house with some land and make a garden. And Lincolnshire was one of these lost places where people didn't go, and that was possible. So on that basis, I went to Lincolnshire. Other people might have gone to Wales. Earlier than that, people would have come to Cornwall. But then Lincolnshire was a place you could go and it could work, so I went there. And I started making work, the kind of work which is made with plants in this exhibition. I developed this idea of how you could make a picture from a plant in a dark room in the winter of 84, 85. And so that came out of cultivating a garden and understanding how plants grow, and the way I made pictures in a dark room, and how I could work directly from a plant to make an image visible without needing a camera to exist. So kind of I'd begun that practice. I started being in exhibitions in the late 80s. It was a good time for artists working with the environment, and so I was in these shows, and by chance, in a year, two or three of these exhibitions travelled to Exeter Museum, Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter. They were venues on tours for shows from the V&A and other institutions. And so in a year I was in two shows that went there, and I went to the museum to do an equivalent event to this, and I met Naomi. She was a curator there. Quite rapidly we established a relationship. And I kind of left my life in Lincolnshire and came to live with her in Devon. And we didn't have a garden for a year. And I carried on making my pictures in the area close to her home. And we wanted to find somewhere to live, to make a garden together and have a family. And we looked, where could we go? Where could we buy a house that would have this potential? And we came and looked in places in Cornwall. We wanted to try and find somewhere. Ideally, Dartmoor would have been a place we'd like. And this particular house became available. It was unusually built. It meant that we had land and we had a house, and its construction made it challenging for other people to buy. It was 100 years old when we bought it, and it was made of wood, the whole house. And so we could afford this house, and we bought it. And then we started to make a garden. And we're still there, nearly 38 years or so later, making a garden. So we really were only getting to know each other, I suppose. But we knew we wanted to make a life like this. And this is a manifestation of it.
And was that, right from that point where you saw the house and you decided to buy it, you saw yourself being able to use the garden and your making of the garden, your interaction with the garden, as being part of your artistic practice?
Well, it had been and was, but it could exist. So a lot of this I haven't thought a lot about until now. Mm-hmm. You and I have worked together on various things. I've done books recently where I'm looking at this idea of a way of living and exhibitions and so on. And this Kestrel Barton project meant that when they asked me if I'd like to do an exhibition, I wasn't sure what it might be. And then I thought, well, I really would like to do an exhibition about our garden. And this seemed to be a place to think about doing that and to make an exhibition appropriate for this size space. And so probably I wouldn't have started that last October. I was already working on a project called The Crucible, which is about the environment I live in on Dartmoor, about an 8-mile circle, which was quite a big part of the exhibition I did at Arnolfini. And that was the book I was working on about the crucible, trying to explain what this place is. And my garden is in the middle of the crucible, this area of landscape which I inhabit. And so that's all been part, that kind of project, because this came up. And yep. I started focusing on this. And I knew I wanted to do a catalogue so that there was some kind of sense of this garden for people that were interested, what it actually looked like, and for them to begin to understand how pictures come out of this place, and it's all one one thing. It's a kind of, what is it? It's a kind of energy system. We inhabit the garden. You know, we're nurtured and cared for by the garden, and we look after the garden. And, you know, pictures appear from the garden. Pictures like this, you know, which are kind of abstracted experiences. And then in the days I made pictures like this, these were pictures made from the plants one was cultivating or the trees that we lived with across time. So it all begins to be one thing.
Okay. Well, let's come. We'll come back to a moment in your kind of practice, how you make the pictures that hang on these walls. But I just want to sort of keep on the garden and art theme for a little while, and because there are other great connections between artists and gardens, artists who've made their own gardens, like Derek Jarman, perhaps, or Ian Hamilton Finlay up in Scotland, Barbara Hepworth even at St Ives. And did you have a sense of how your own, you know, were there any kind of models or templates?
So in the publication I did for the Arnold Feeney exhibition called The Door, there's a beautiful picture of Marjorie Fish. So Marjorie Fish was a woman who made a garden in Somerset, in South Petherton. And when I was about 19 or 20, I went to this garden. She made it in the kind of 1950s, 1960s, and she wrote books about making a garden. We Made a Garden, I think, was one of the books. And I went there, and I just knew I was somewhere very special. And so it was something about being in this garden, this individual's vision of what a garden might be, and finding yourself in this garden. And at the same time, when I was 19, I'd be seeing exhibitions by, say, in Bristol. I live near Bristol. I'd see exhibitions, so I'd see an exhibition, say, of Hamish Fulton, Richard Long. That would kind of suggest to me about how I could have a relationship to landscape and use photography, but no more significantly than going to Marjorie Fish's garden. So I knew that her garden was as important as this art. And then kind of later in life, I would meet people like the potter Richard Batterham, who's a kind of hero of mine, and I've done exhibitions about him, and he was in the Arnold Feeney exhibition. And he brought up five children, made some of the most important, you know, post-war pottery in this country, in his workshop next to his garden. And I would go and visit him and buy his pots and see him in his garden. And these were examples of people who were living a life where the making, the economy of selling, bringing up a family, created the framework for what life should be. And so, as someone who was an artist who has to make a living through the things I make, these kinds of examples were really important, because it showed it was possible to do this, and that's what we tried to do. And, you know, had a family, made a garden, made work, found people who wanted to have this work, and let everything grow together. And we did this with nothing except our own resources, and it's possible to do it. And if I can do it, anyone can do it. And that's kind of where we've reached. And Derek Jarman's an important example, because he's like one of the few contemporary examples we have. I mean, Derek's garden is such a small, specific thing, but it's so important, because we need examples, and he's one of very few. And Ian Hamilton Finlay is obviously another. And he had this wonderful life when he had all his kids there in the early days of making his garden. So, yeah, and so the pictures of Ian Hamilton Finlay and Alec, his son, and his daughter on the boat, on the pond and so on, are really, really important pictures if you want an example of the way how life might be.
But I think I get the definite sense, and again from reading your piece in the catalogue, which I commend to you, available in this very gallery for £10, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, really important that it's £10. You know, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, £10, wow.
Two frothy cappuccinos, and you can have something that will last a lot longer than those, ladies and gentlemen. But you write in it that the gardeners cared for us and nurtured us. And so, you know, it's very interesting in sort of the Asia, the kind of focus on well-being and green spaces and the health and mental health benefits of garden spaces. And I definitely got that sense from your piece, and one gets it from your work in spades, that there is a... We're almost going back to almost a kind of a much earlier sense of the benefits that nature as a whole, but gardens and cultivated spaces bring to us as human beings. And that sense in the monastic world, that gardens, cloister gardens, are places where you can retreat from the world and kind of renew and refresh yourself. And can you talk to us a little bit more about that, the way in the sense that you and Naomi obviously cultivated the garden and nurtured it, but it nurtured you in return?
Well, I can say what I think about that. I don't know. I think... I think that... But for living within the garden and within the place I call the crucible, I can't function. And I understand that I have to have boundaries and I have to have a sustaining space around me. And then I can be at maximum capacity in what I might achieve. Or in our relationship where we talk about photography. So we have a relationship, Richard and I, through... Richard's role at the Bodleian. I'm an honorary fellow at the Bodleian, and he published my memoir called Darkroom. And so we have a relationship around what photography in the darkroom is and a life lived in this kind of space. And for me to make work in the darkroom and in my studio, I can only do that if I'm in the garden and I'm within the crucible. And this is where life makes sense. And if I go too far outside of these spaces, it falls apart. Mm. And so I accept that if I live that way, then I might achieve what's necessary. And if I try to be in other places, I just can't function properly. So it sustains me, and I accept it. And there's a sense of peace. Mm-hmm. And I'm giving up a lot to stay within that enclosure. And I understand the monastic life and why... people need to live in this kind of way, and I respect it. And I respect the people that live in a more complicated way. And so points in my life when, like, there was a period in the 90s when I spent quite a lot of time in Japan, and, you know, my work was very popular in Japan, and I would go to Tokyo, and I'd be in Tokyo, and it was like as if I was on another planet, and I was in a completely other place. But I survived. And within this place, there were people who profoundly understood my work.
Yeah.
And they were living the opposite life of me, but they knew somehow within who they were.
Yeah.
Culturally, that in the pictures that they knew and what they knew about my work, there was something which they clearly understood in the way they. In our garden, in some of the photos, and when you go down into the woods, you know, we have trees there and we have rocks there, which would be worshipped in Japan. And, you know, we see them every day, several times a day, and there's a kind of sense of reverence, but just normality. And, it's unsaid. But something incredibly powerful exists in our life continuously.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible privilege.
And I think that's one of the things which you can see in this show, particularly on the wall behind us, is that sense of the dynamics of nature, of the biorhythms of the of a year of growth, growth, and the power of the sun, photosynthesis, and then kind of eventual decay, but the latency of seeds and so on, and that sense of the natural order and the that kind of biorhythm of life you see in particularly the work on this wall. Mm-hmm. And could you tell us a little bit about those?
Right.
Those,
okay.
The more evolutionary.
So interesting, is it? I mean, I'm not often in a room where people talk to me about biorhythms and and stuff. You know, it kind of like it's just everyday normal life, kind of breathing. But that makes you realise how lucky you are to live the life you do, because, all these small things which we have every day in our lives is why we commit to it. And it's just like an intuitive thing, and we've managed to make it work.
But it's also observation.
Yeah. But it's felt. It's felt, and you look for it. So it is like a leaf seeking out the sun. And so I've made a lot of photosynthesis pictures when I work with plants. I make a lot of work about light as an energy system and the way that I'm soaking up every minute of light in my day, like the tree. And so I kind of believe in all of that. And I want maximum exposure. I want as much light falling upon me as it's possible to do, always. And I've developed a way of making pictures which is about a maximum exposure to light. And, I developed a practice where I had a piece of paper and you could put light upon it, and the quantities of light would make things appear or disappear or exist. So in these flower pictures on this wall, they're two very simple ideas. I've never shown that picture and this picture in the same gallery before. That picture I haven't shown, that's 1989. It's a delphinium flower from a herbaceous border in our garden. And so it's about the size of the end of my finger. It's like a candle form, the delphinium, and I'm taking one of the flower bulblets off the flower, and I'm taking it to my dark room, and it's a three-dimensional object, so I have to place it in the head of the photographic enlarger, where you would have put a transparency taken by a camera in the past. And so I put the flower in there. The flower is a volume, so I have to, with my nail, I kind of cut the side of the flower so I can compress the shape to be the shape you see there, and that flower is there, the beam of light shines, and I give different exposures, so that's almost like an exposure test. And different exposures show different states of the flower, and at the end, I suppose, is the correctly exposed flower, but my view is that the kind of spirit is within the kind of state of it becoming visible into the world. So that picture's about something like that, and so is this picture, which is called Fading Iris. And so by putting increasing quantities of light into the picture, into the flower, the petal, it disappears. But I think the spirit is here in this kind of transitory place. So that picture is made across half a day of exposures, and so is that one. That's 1989, this is probably 2011. An iris petal off of an iris is this one, and this is the delphinium. This is an iris petal, three different iris petals. So that's how they're made. But the key thing is it's to do with the amount of light given and received. in the life of the flower and in my life. Mm. And then the opposite of that is the darkness. So all the pictures are made in the dark room, which is a black space with no light. And I have no light at all. In a cibachrome dark room, you can have no light except the beam of light you're working with. So that's like the night space where, you know, you go to match the saturation of daylight space. So in our life, you know, we move in maximum exposure in the garden, in the wider landscape, and at night we go into the garden and it's dark, and all of this stuff is happening in the darkness, which is like me going into the dark room. Mm. And it's just normal everyday life, and it's incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
And so I'm experiencing life like that, and so are the plants. So
and you're able to kind of reflect that through your...
Well, I'm fortunate that the invention of photography allows us to make things exist in this way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like it's an optimum human moment, and it's like a great manifestation of human nature.
Well, I think this is a good point to sort of actually bring us back to the fact that your practice is a photographic one, but it's not a traditional photographic one in the sense of a lens and a camera and film or digital work. It's what we call cameraless photography. And there are lenses, but there's no camera. And lots of the earliest photography was made in a similar way or in a kind of analogous way. And how much of that early photography, people like William Henry Fox Talbot, Anna Atkins, William Herschel, have been influences on your work?
So when did I, as a young person, see this work? I wouldn't have seen much of it. You know, we didn't see a lot of it. You know, in the 70s, we didn't see a lot of early photography. But I spent a lot of my teenage years learning about photography, you know, in the sense we had things like Time Life books.
We talked about that. Yeah. I too. This big kind of encyclopedia of photography. Yeah. We both.
Yeah, and so these books were fundamental, and you'd look at them and you would see Henri Cartier-Bresson, you would see Edward Weston, you would see early Fox Talbots, you'd see Anna Atkins, and this is how you saw photography, because it didn't exist in galleries and museums didn't show it in that way. And this is just like, perhaps of no interest to anyone, but it really is very significant, it seems to me. So, and someone in this room, who I've never met until today, said to me that they had met at Bayeux the printer in London last week. They were printing pictures for an exhibition, and they met Philippe Garner, who was printing pictures for an exhibition of his own pictures to show at Hamilton's.
Yeah.
And Philippe Garner is the kind of person who established the photography auction market globally in the world. He's an amazing man, and he's now a retired guy. And, you know, he's a really special guy. And when he came to my dark room, he looked at my larger, which was propped up on my library of Time Life things to reach the projection height I wanted, and he just kind of melted down, because it was like unbelievable that we'd reached this point. But it was just me doing make-do-in-men darkroom practice to get to a certain exposure height, and this is really fundamental in the history of photography, how we work like this, and you and I understand this. And if you're a painter, people kind of understand things like this, but they don't in photography, because a darkroom practice is such an unusual thing, and it's not being valued in one thing or another. And so things like that are really special. So that's how I got to see that work, probably. But what one knew was that the magic of photography was contained in the birthplace. I mean, Richard holds the most significant holdings of Fox Talbot material in the Bodleian Library. And it's wonderful. And being a fellow there, it's meant I've had access to things, you know, which, you know, if I'd had them when I was a young person, couldn't say what effect it had on me. But to have the last few years had chance, I've seen every John Herschel picture in the History of Science Museum, and I'm probably one of the last people ever be allowed to see them because they're so fragile. They're from kind of 1839, scraps of paper with things just barely visible on them. You know, this is like the beginning of the lodestone. And it's, you know, I'm just emotional thinking about it. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of photography, we made things appear and allowed them to exist for a period of time. And if Richard doesn't look after his Fox Talbots, they'll disappear. I've seen some of them, you know, like in a kind of nuclear bunker type facility with light levels and light meters and so on. And you do feel you're in the presence of something profound. And it's true, isn't it? Mm. So for me, I discovered that really if I could make work which appeared out of this, the ability for photography to make something appear just by working with a beam of light in a dark space, something really, really intense is happening. And at the end of my kind of practice, as my dark room's closed now, you know, it was as if, well, basically I was bringing it to an end, it seems like, to me. And there's a few people still making work like this, but not many. And you feel a huge respect, and you know that really you're there with the foundation people. But one of the wonderful things for me is that, it means I've always been an outsider because I've not been part of the main camera-based practice. But for pictures like these two pictures to exist, I've had to evolve. So all of the large-scale pictures I make, of which there are, you know, several hundred now, these are all unique exposures made in the darkroom, like these pictures are. So these are one-off pictures. There is no other copy except this. There isn't a negative, there isn't a transparency. But when I knew that this medium was ending, because none of these materials exist anymore, you can't make these pictures anymore, they're no longer manufactured, I knew that if I could evolve in a different way, I could continue to make my work. So these large pictures are made by taking unique exposures, building digital files from them, and then printing in what would be the conventional photographic practice now. So how I see it is I view the exposures that I've made, which is the kind of archive of images, they're like the archive of negatives of Ansel Adams or Edward Weston, and from those we make our prints. So these kinds of pictures sit within the tradition because the unique exposure has become the negative or the transparency from which we can print and interpret. So like Bill Brandt might make six versions of a Stonehenge under snow picture, I can make six interpretations of a picture from that period. So suddenly I feel like I'm back in the body of photography rather than, you know, the kind of outer edges.
Yeah.
And that's a really nice feeling when your dark room's closed.
What William Henry Fox Talbot said was, every man his own printer or publisher, after he invented the idea of the negative. I realise that we've been talking for
a long time.
Allotted time.
For a long time, me, Richard.
And we don't need anyone in the room to do it either.
Yeah, yeah.
But conscious that there's artwork to see, there's one another's company to enjoy, there's the beautiful garden here at Castle Barton, there are indeed refreshments to be acquired. I've just got one last question.
And they might have a question.
Before we come to the audience questions, one last question for you, Gary, is that we're here in Castle Barton, it's a beautiful day, where could be better in the world? But why is it important for you to show in a place like this?
Good question. It's really important. I've done lots of shows in places like this in my life, and I'm committed to it. So at the moment, I've got this show, it's just opened today, and I've got a show in St. David's in Pembrokeshire, in a really eccentric place, the Pembrokeshire Coast National Park Interpretation Centre in St. David's. And underneath it, there's two fantastic galleries built by the Museum, National Museum of Wales, to show their collection. And I've been in that, those two galleries for 7 months, and they're going to carry on until... For 1 year, I've got this exhibition right on the edge of West Wales. And it's like, it feels like a revolution, because you're, you know, for some reason, I've ended up in this strange place. And so today you can come and see this exhibition, and you can go all the way there to see an exhibition. And that's as important to me as if I was having a show in New York and in Tokyo. And that's how it should be. Mm. So I want exhibitions to be everywhere. And I want, if I live in Pembrokeshire or I live in Cornwall, you're lucky if you live in Cornwall, because you know, it's been part of your life, hasn't it, if you're a young person for decades. Kind of an access to art as normal. But if you live in, I don't know, or if you live in Somerset, you know, it's very hard to get access if you don't live in large centres of population. So I've always really wanted to show in places where people can just come across art in an everyday way. Like when we were young, Richard, we'd go to the library and we would have access to all these books, and they would change our lives. Mm. And you know, art should exist like that. So when I lived in Lincolnshire, so these are some examples of what I did. In 85, I lived in Lincolnshire, and in 2 summers, I did 6 exhibitions in an old chicken shed in my garden, which we kind of painted up and stuff. And the first show I did was Andy Goldsworthy, who came and made work in my garden, put it in the shed. I did a show with Chris Drury, Hamish Fulton, who's done a show here, Roger Ackling, who's done a show here. And all these people kind of committed to come and do a show, and hardly anyone came to these shows. But they existed, and people did come. And you could go around the art world, and you see posters up for them in the Tate and so on, as if they were, you know, and they were just in a chicken shed in Lincolnshire. But it was saying that art should exist everywhere in these places, and everyone should have access to it. And so I've done a number of shows over the years like that. I've done shows in Orkney, I've done shows in Mull, and it really matters. And I think if you were lucky enough to have been a young person in Cornwall, you can't underestimate how fortunate you've been to have art kind of in shops scattered here, there and everywhere. It's really special. I've done lots of shows in Cornwall over the years. I've done 2 shows at New Lynn. I've showed at Tate, St. Ives. And it's really important. But it's really important to show in big cities as well. Yeah. And take this kind of art to those places. Sure. But yeah, so when they asked me to do a show here, I was really excited, because it was another show in Cornwall in a special place. Yeah. And for all the people who don't come, they know this show's happening, and they think, why the hell are you doing a show down some muddy lanes, you know, near the Lizard? And think about it, why am I? You know, they should think about it, you know, because yeah, it's just as important as doing a show at the Baltic in Newcastle.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's now your turn to ask Gary some questions about his work, the work that's hanging on the walls in this room. Who would like to go first? Yes.
Well, you're in such a good place, because you've got me and Richard here. And Richard's looking after, you know, what's left of so much important photographic material. I'm doing a show, this is my version of how I'm answering. So I'm doing a show at the Ashmolean at the end of the year, and I want to have in that show 3 or 4 Fox Talbots from 1839, the real things, sacred objects, revered, fragile, precious. But to show them, one's going to have to create an environment where they will survive. And the temptation will be to show facsimiles of them. And it's unclear how we can resolve this. Maybe we have to circulate them in different ways. But I think, even if there's just the faint trace left, there's something very, very powerful. These are pictures from 1839 that I think we should have access to, not a facsimile of them. And this is a dilemma Richard will have. I'm asking to do it, and other people will ask to do it. These pictures are fragile, they need to be looked after, but so does everything. And things don't last forever. So if someone owns this picture, it will survive their lifetime, but it might not survive beyond that. But that's how it is. Richard has a responsibility which is different to mine. If you own this picture, how you look after it is your choice. I'm not stressed about it, really. Enough will survive. What do you think?
Your work is less fugitive than Talbot's at the moment.
Fugitive is a fantastic word.
Yeah. So the early photography, which is based on silver and the processing of that silver during the production of the prints, leaves silver that has not reacted to light, and so it's that gradual reaction over time that creates the problem. What Larry Scharf calls the original sin of photography.
It's fantastic fugitive, original sin.
But this work, and Gary's work, uses a different process, but it does react to light over time. So it's that limiting the exposure to light. And it doesn't have, it's not necessarily the amount of time or it's not necessarily the intensity of light, but it's the total amount of exposure to light that's the issue, what we call lux hours rather than necessarily lux intensity.
That's very nice in the connection of how it comes in so close to garden plants. It's a parallel of the life cycle of how things last and how things exist.
What are you going to do about it, Richard? Do you think, are we going to have the fox talbot?
That's a fair question, Gary. I need to consult my conservation expert.
But can I just say, a lot of what I say is niche to some extent, but I've got this image which is really important. So we've got our friend in New York. What's he called?
Hans Krauss.
So Hans Krauss had a show in London of his personal fox talbots at the time of Photo London, and he had them behind curtains.
This is a dealer, by the way. So this is a dealer in his stock.
And he had this public exhibition. Incredibly kind and generous of him to do this. Okay, he could sell them. And he had curtains across them, and he was there in the room, and he would go up to people and he'd say, "No, put curtains across," because they'd been exposed for too long, and he was policing it himself. It was just so amazing, and what respect you have to have for him. That is niche what I said, but it really is matters, doesn't it, to us? And it really, and when you see the material, the original material I've had access to through the work I've been doing with Richard in Oxford, it really is profound. When you have a huge responsibility once you've been one of the people who've seen it, as to how do you communicate this to others who can't see it.
But you don't want it. The challenge is you don't want it to end up to being like Schrodinger's photograph, where if you take it out of the box that you normally keep it in, it will disappear. But if you keep it in the box and don't look at it, you know that there's this amazing photograph. So that's the challenge that is at the heart of all curatorial practice, really. It's that balance between conservation
and...
I've come to terms with it. It's there for every kind of collection that any museum or library holds, that balance between preservation and access. But it is most acute with silver-based photography from the early years of the science.
Any question about, slugs or... not in this particular niche. Anyway, who next?
More questions.
Can I ask a question about materials?
Yeah.
So you mentioned that the materials you used to make these aren't available anymore.
Yeah.
Which is a bummer, because I was so inspired to go and try and make these things from my own garden.
Yeah.
So Is there a replacement
Good question. That
allows you or anyone who wants to explore this practice to use it?
How should I answer that? What I think is you should be hopeful. I'm not going to give the right kind of... So there's a really good movement. They call themselves kind of alternative photographic processes.
Yeah.
Many of them are women. And they have a huge amount of energy. And they're exploring ways of working with natural materials to make images appear. The difficulty is keeping them here when they're here. And so... I have huge respect for these people, and they're really trying to keep photography alive using natural materials. And so I'd say the best thing to do is to probably what I would do is tell Rhea some of these kind of links and stuff and these people. And they, I think, didn't you have alternative processes come here?
Yeah, sustainable dark. Yeah, sustainable. Here last summer, workshop.
Yeah, and Falmouth, you know, having in, and you know, these people are making it possible. You know, I go and do talks with them and stuff, and I think it's a really wonderful community of people who are trying to keep it alive. I'm working in other ways now, so it is possible. We shouldn't be depressed and give up.
And you can go to classes and learn how to do it. So these photographers like Joe Gain is one of them, and we had a show a few years ago where. Gary's work was exhibited as part of these groups who are making photographs with strawberries and cucumber and also, and we did workshops with school children. So, you know, these.
But there's a lot of significant artists working with these materials, aren't there? But I don't feel I can go into any more detail because I'm kind of out of my depth. But you shouldn't despair, and we could direct you sensibly.
How wild
did
your garden?
We, as it says in the catalogue, we kind of started cultivating a garden around our house, and really we've given up in a way because we think, well, I think, I can't say we, Naomi can say what she thinks, kind of like the problem is, what is a garden on Dartmoor? And we started off thinking it was a garden like Marjorie Fish, and then as time came past, we realised this really wasn't a garden on Dartmoor, and we stopped gardening in conventional ways, and we had a herbaceous border probably as long as this. We got rid of that after we'd made it. It lasted about 8 years, and it just wasn't the right thing to be doing. And so gradually the garden's moved away from the house, and it's gone down into the woods, down to the river. And we're trying to find a way that human beings cultivating plants within this environment looks as if it belongs, and it will disappear when we disappear. And we are fortunate to have got this woodland now with these remarkable ancient and veteran trees. I think somewhere, Sam Manning, I saw was here earlier. Is he still here? There he is. So Sam from Woodland Trust has been to the woods. And so you know, we have these amazing trees and so on. So we think the garden is much more a relationship between us and its natural, and we're letting ourselves kind of go in some way. But I think the river garden, which I call Naomi's River Garden, is like the heart of the garden. And that's now a good walk away from our house. And it will change again, and it will become more wild in the way you're saying. I'm quite emotional because it does feel as if we're giving ourselves over to the evolving garden, and it kind of is leading us. And it wasn't like that when we began. We were led by other gardeners.
I've tried to phrase some sort of comment that relates to the previous generations, say Cornwall or Dartmoor, and their gardens and the relationship with your garden is an inheritor of obviously a tradition to some extent of sort of peasant gardens across Europe and elsewhere, but the interest in, your interest in light, can we project that back into the medieval period? I'm thinking of that garden at Tintagel, for example. What were they thinking of there, the medieval garden? And then maybe prehistoric people who we know were interested in light, so many of their structures relate to the changing seasons and the passage of light. So, but I just wonder whether you saw your garden in any sense having a link with such things.
Mm, okay, so quite enjoying this. So that's Tom Greaves, who asked that question, and I haven't seen Tom for several years. Tom and I did a book called Homeland Darfur, back kind of 2009, I don't know, something like that. And it was all about Dartmoor and the people that inhabited Dartmoor, of which we were the current manifestation. And so Tom and I would spend a lot of time walking on Dartmoor, sites on Dartmoor, speculating about lives lived on Dartmoor. And the kind of sharing in the place I call the Crucible, the sharing of a life lived with the sun and the moon and such like were a lot of what we would talk about. How much I thought about a commitment to gardening beyond survival in growing of food to sustain oneself, I don't really kind of know. And I'm really interested in, only Tom could say, the light garden in Tintagel, as if we all know what he's talking about. And I think, why? What is this? You know, this. What is it, Tom?
The garden in Tintagel?
Yeah.
It's in an enclosure. I mean, it doesn't have anything growing within it. It's just the basic structure
of where it would have been.
Well, it's still intact. It's a pure, proper medieval garden structure, but it isn't planted up with what might have been there. But and it's a 13th century space that was intended to be a garden for whatever reason. But when you think of
isn't that exciting?
Very.
Yeah. I haven't asked the question really, Tom, have I?
I was only
throwing it out. Yeah.
We have another question over here.
Hi. I'm curious about the Crucible and why you call it that.
Yeah.
Any reference to other villas or other rituals?
No, I'm really pleased I called this exhibition Our Garden. And names really matter. So Our Garden is a thing which exists now, it seems to me. You know, I've claimed Our Garden and I want it to exist. This exhibition is a manifestation of it. I want it to continue to exist. The Crucible, I wanted to give an identity to this circle that I walk in. And I called it the Crucible because I felt that within it everything is in flux, and everything can exist and everything can come into being within this place, and I see these things continuously which become the pictures I make, and every day something happens there which changes me, and I feel part of the thing Tom Greaves is asking about. Tom's an important archaeologist, where I feel like I'm part of the passage of people occupying this space. And I'm slipping between different periods of time. And I call it the Crucible. This name came up with the Crucible because it just suggested something continually burning, which was changing, and I was being absorbed and being part of it, and it would carry on when I wasn't in it, and so on. And it, you know, and we could all draw a circle around a place that we feel we inhabit, and things are happening to us. It's a powerful name, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Arthur Miller Hewler. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go on. Anyone else is going everywhere here, aren't they?
Any more questions?
I've got a really annoying question which is bugging me. Oh. I'm not sure brave enough to ask it.
Go for it.
But it just seems to me that it's like a progression of being born to death or death.
That's not boring,
is it? Well, I don't know. But, you know, I kind of, if I hung these pictures, I want to change them around.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they could be hung the other way around, and I would do that. Yeah, no. So that's... So where is it? Is it important that it's something which appears to be coming into the world or leaving the world?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. But is it the same thing? Things disappearing and life ending is as important as life appearing, isn't it?
And they look like veins, they look like arteries.
Those are really good things to say. Yeah, absolutely. Come on, let's have one more. What a patient group of people.
I'm just curious, on that, would you have them differently in Tokyo?
I definitely would encourage you to hang them in different ways. In that.
But when you read from left to right.
I'm in this show. I'm going to do the Ashmolean. I've got a picture which I've only ever shown horizontally. It's a kind of progression. So what it is, it's called Harvest, and it's a 1990 picture, and it's 10 circles, and it's incredibly like this. A lot of my pictures are the same. So it starts with one layer of, if you take the plant honesty and you cut a circle, with my nail, I cut a circle out of the tissue of the honesty seed head, which is transparent. And the first picture is one circle, and then I accumulate circles, and the last one is 10 circles stacked on top of each other, so they're holding back huge amounts of light, and it becomes a dark circle of matter. And the beginning ones, where it's coming into visibility, are kind of like a skin of tissue. And so it's always been hung going from light to dark. In the middle it goes golden, like a harvest of corn. So when I show it in Oxford, we're going to show it vertically so that the darkness is down by the earth and the lightness is by the sky, by the sun. And the middle of the picture, circle 5, is the golden harvest. And then that picture, the reason I'm doing that is because it's going to hang next to a painting of Samuel Palmer's of a crop of corn. And so those two pictures are going to hang on the same middle eye line. And I would never have hung it, but the chance to show it next to this Samuel Palmer means that this picture called Harvest is about the golden middle place. But for the exhibition, I would never have that chance. And so that picture will never be the same again. I gave quite emotional, because who would have ever thought that would hang next to this 1827 painting? But such is life in Oxford, it can happen.
Indeed.
Yeah, so I think, the way you hang series is quite important, and it should be free.
Okay.
I like the way you said earlier about all this is going on in the dark.
Mm.
I haven't really got a question, I just thought
it was But because my dark room is closed, because the materials are gone, that's ever so sad, obviously. It still exists, it's there, you can go into it, I could go in and close the door and be in the dark of the dark room, but it's inert. It's a cave.
It's very dark.
But like last night, because we're both, aren't we, great Kestrel Barton people? We're both at Kestrel Barton last night, aren't we? We come back. Richard goes to where he's staying. I'm staying in what they call the artist's house over here. And we kind of stand outside, and Richard says to me, gosh, living in Oxford, I don't get this access to this night space. And, obviously I'm privileged. I have this night space on Dartmoor. And so I go out at night, and I just kind of stand there nowadays, and I just think about being in the dark room.
Mm.
And all I do is just be there. Mm. I don't make anything. It just is a very sustaining experience. Anyone else? What more?
Sorry, what are the materials that you can't get?
You can't get this thing called Cibachrome, this particular paper. doesn't exist, it's no longer made, the market died, the people using it faded away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that and that's the only paper which allows you to make pictures like this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I spent the last, I spent, 10 years bringing it to an end, and then it ended. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've come to an end, but join me in thanking